Okay, well, my name's Tony, and you all know me, and I'm going to be talking about burst oscillations on neutron stars. So this is some work that Lars and I have been thinking about for quite a few years now, and there's kind of a puzzlement of what these burst oscillations are, and we finally actually posted a paper about it just on Monday. Yeah, is it? So here's just an outline of what I'm going to talk about. So I'm going to begin by revealing accreting neutron stars, X-ray bursts, and burst oscillations. And a lot of this will kind of be similar to what Nevin talked about, I guess, about 2 weeks ago, but kind of a reminder. And then I'm going to move on to comparisons between the magnetic neutron stars and the non-magnetic systems. And there's a lot of important differences that will bear out on the theory that I'll discuss. And then finally, kind of the meat of the talk is just the theory of surface modes on neutron stars. So I'm going to review what shallow gravity waves are, and then apply this in the context of neutron stars when they're bursting. And then finish up by just talking about comparisons with observations and trying to find some sort of constraints on the properties of neutron star crusts. So what are these systems that we're looking at? So these are low-mass X-ray binaries, and basically what you have is a neutron star, which is kind of has a fiducial mass of 1.4 solar masses and a radius of 10 kilometers, and it's accreting in a binary with an orbital period of a few hours to half a day. And the accretion rates are typically 10 to the minus 10 to 10 to the minus 8 solar masses a year, and this translates into a luminosity of 10 to the 36 to 10 to the 38 Earths per second. Now, if you just ask, if I have a proton and I drop it onto this neutron star, how much energy do I get out of it? I get 200 MeV per neutron. And the important thing to contrast this with is how much do you get from actually burning that proton on the surface of the star? And that's only 5 MeV per proton. So just on the face of it, you'd think that the emission from this neutron star would be totally dominated by this gravitational potential energy, and you would never see any of the nuclear energy being emitted. So that's not quite true, and the reason why is because you could release a lot of this nuclear energy in a very short amount of time. So here's some eye candy. So here's a neutron star, and then we have ignition at some spot on it. And whoa. So. It's very dangerous. Okay, so you see that, the burning spread over the star, and that's a type 1 X-ray burst.
It's more of a reveal.
Okay. So we have unstable helium ignition on the surface of the star after you've accreted enough material. And the kind of picture you want to see is, here's column depth, there's pressure going into the star, and here's the temperature of the star. So as you accrete, you keep on adding material, and at the base of the accreted layer, you're going to higher and higher pressures, higher densities and temperatures. And eventually, you get to this unstable curve, where if you just perturb your temperature, you get more triple alpha reactions than you'd be able to cool, more energy being generated than you can cool. And at this point, the column becomes unstable, and you have this burning happen. So these bursts repeat every few hours to days, which is just the time scale to get this unstable column. And the amount of energy released is 5 times 10 to the 39 ergs, is kind of the standard number you expect. So these bursts will have different properties, though, depending on what kind of fuel you're igniting. So the kind of the quantity that lets you get at this property is this alpha number. And basically what it is you're averaging over the accretion luminosity versus the averaging over the luminosity from the burst. In this case, for example, if you're just burning hydrogen and helium, so it's like a solar composition, this ratio will just be the two energies I discussed before. You're going to have 200 MeV from your gravitational potential energy versus 5 MeV from burning. So this ratio would be something like 40. So this is what you get for hydrogen helium burning, and typically you have a lot of proton captures, which gives you a very extended light curve as you burn all this, you proton capture all these heavy elements. So these typically have like a 100-second cooling time scale. And you can see this is for a large number of bursts, all kind of laid on top of each other. And then the alpha values have been calculated for these guys. And you can see right here, they're all kind of in the range of 40, which gives a consistent picture that it's a solar type composition that's being ignited.
This is for one particular
system. This is for one particular system. On other times, if you have more helium rich fuel that you're burning, now you don't have all these proton captures happening. And you release much less energy in the burst. And so your alphas are higher, like 100, and your light curves are much shorter. So you have efolding time scales of 2 to 10 seconds. And those are actually, we're going to see more of those, because those are actually the kind of bursts that show burst oscillations. So this phenomena is often during the burst, here's the light curve again, for what's now a kind of a helium-rich type burst. So you can see the short time scale. And then plotted on top of it is a dynamic Fourier transform. So here's the frequency. And then you can see the frequency, there's some power, and it's changing in frequency over time. And often you'll see sometimes oscillations during the rise, and then also oscillations during the tail. Now the oscillations during the rise, the amplitude evolution, the frequency evolution is actually consistent with you have an ignited hot spot, and it's kind of spreading over the surface of the star. So we think we kind of understand this part fairly well. What's much more of a puzzle is what's creating this asymmetry on the star surface, 10, 20 seconds after the entire surface has been enveloped by the ignition. So at this point, you expect the entire surface to have burned, and it's a real question, what's causing this asymmetry? And so you can see, often there's a kind of a rise to this frequency. There's a 1 to 5 hertz drift. And then you, for a given system, you always asymptote to some frequency for that system.
Could you start with when you say this? Asymmetry, what is the asymmetry?
So to see an oscillation, you need something on the surface that's asymmetrical in a hot spot. So as you spin around, you see this oscillation. So one idea to explain this drift, but not necessarily explain the asymmetry, is that it's this angular momentum conservation. So you have the burst, it heats up the layer, and so it expands out. And it's just like the old figure skater problem, right? If the arms go out, it slows down. And then as the burst cools, the layers fall back down, and they start spinning up. So this was proposed by Strohmeyer a while ago, and then Andrew Cumming and then Lars and other people started trying to actually calculate this in more detail, and they found you can't actually get drifts this large with this mechanism. It underpredicts it by at least a factor of 2 or so.
Tony, is it really true that you only see these burst oscillations in helium?
In the short bursts, yeah.
You never see them in the long bursts?
Yeah.
Is there an explanation as to why?
No.
I mean, it's not an observational selection effect or anything, because...
No, I mean, you see plenty of long bursts.
Yeah.
But there's other correlations, like radius expansions and so forth, that correlate with all these things. So there might be different... if the burst oscillations depend on the fuel or something like that, it's not impossible. I'll discuss it a little more. So the other key factor is this asymptotic frequency that it goes to is characteristic for each system. So these are 6 different systems here, and here's the fractional frequency change versus the asymptotic frequency. And you can see these are in days, so these are many years for each of these observations. And each of these systems are stable with the same frequency within about 1 part in 1,000. And so here's a list of all the systems and all the frequencies. From high to low, high to low frequency. So when you start seeing the stability like this from burst to burst, and you're starting to see frequencies kind of in the range you expect for kind of like millisecond pulsars, you start thinking, well, maybe it's just the spin of the star that you're seeing. But the problem is, for these systems, there's no other way to determine what the spin is. So you can't, I ever ask that question, say, oh, the spin is this, the burst oscillation frequency is this, they're the same. You can't do that. So there are another set of systems, the accreting millisecond pulsars, And what these are is you have a neutron star, and here's the spin axis, and then there's a magnetic axis. And let's say they're not aligned. As the disk comes in, eventually the ram pressure of the disk will be balanced by the magnetic pressure. And then the accretion flow will just be channeled onto the magnetic axis, magnetic pole. And then you have this hot X-ray spot right here. And as it whips around, you're going to see oscillations from that. So in these types of systems, you really know what the spin frequency is. So these guys have frequencies in the range of kind of like the burst oscillations. And just from the argument of how this material is coming in and to get channeling to happen, you need a certain size magnetic field for a given accretion rate. So kind of the standard magnetic field is something around 10^8 Gauss or 10^9 Gauss. Okay. So what would be really great is if one of these systems showed a burst oscillation, and you say, now I know what's going on here. So actually two have. So one is 1808 and the other is 1814. So these are the X-ray bursts from these systems. And then here's the burst oscillations. And in these cases, the burst oscillation frequency is equal to the spin frequency. But then you start looking at these in detail, and you go, well, maybe it's not as simple as that. And the problem is there's a lot of differences between these systems and the burst oscillations and the systems that aren't magnetic, or they don't show signs of magnitude. And it's just kind of, qualitatively, you really see it here. So for example, there's no frequency drift at all in these guys. So that's kind of strange. And then these systems actually show the burst oscillations in the longer burst, so like this one right here, where the other systems have never shown that. So it still kind of remains a puzzle for the non-pulsars, what's creating the asymmetry? So this kind of lists all the differences between the systems, and there's actually even more than this. So like I said previously, non-pulsars show oscillations only in the short bursts, while the pulsars have shown the oscillations in the longer bursts. The non-pulsars show the drifts, while there's no drifts for the pulsars. And then there's even more details. So for example, the non-pulsars have very sinusoidal oscillations, so there's never been any harmonic contact detected. But for the pulsars, you can actually start seeing harmonics in the oscillations. And then another thing is if you look at the pulse amplitude as a function of energy, it's actually different between the two types of objects also. So there's all these differences, so that really kind of supports the hypothesis that maybe there's a different mechanism here that we can try to explore. So kind of the most obvious mechanism to start thinking about is non-radio oscillations. So it's kind of the most obvious way to create a late-time surface asymmetry in this liquid on the surface of the neutron star. So this was actually initially calculated a little while ago by McDermott and Tam, but this is before burst oscillations were even discovered, by about 10 years or so. So a lot of the important details I'm going to talk about for the model, such as having a high spin, and taking into account the different layers in the surface, they didn't include any of this. And then more recently, this cause has been hypothesized by Heil, who mainly just considered kind of the angular distribution of the mode. What angular eigenfunction do you need to reproduce the properties of burst oscillations? And so because of that, supported the burst oscillations are maybe modes because they're very sinusoidal, but the angular and radial eigenfunctions are which ones you can possibly have be the burst oscillations are severely restricted by all the characteristics of these frequencies. So Heil's identified kind of what the angular structure must be if it's a mode, and I'll kind of come back to that later, but the more pressing issue is what's the radial structure of the mode through this hot bursting layer. So that's what I'm going to focus on now. And so to do that, I have to kind of give a review of surface gravity waves. So unfortunately, most of us don't get to take fluid mechanics in these days in physics. So let's just consider a simple problem of a liquid layer with a depth h above a rigid core. Okay, and so you have some wavelength, which is just 2 pi over the wave vector. So the wave vector kind of a natural quantity to use, so I'll be using that. But just remember that as the wave vector gets large, then the wavelength is small, and vice versa. So if you just ask what kind, you disturb the surface, and you ask what's the frequency of the oscillation that on the surface, you just get, it's kind of maybe hard to see at the bottom, omega squared is just gk times the hyperbolic tangent of kh. Okay, so it's standard classical problem. But then there's some important shallow and deep limits to this equation, to this dispersion relation. So the first is, let's consider what happens if the layer is very deep. And what I mean by that is that the height of the layer is much larger than the wavelength. So in that case, this hyperbolic tangent just becomes 1, and the frequency squared is just gk. So if you ask what's the phase of, so if you have this kind of wave, and you ask what's the phase velocity, what's the group velocity, what you find is for this, since it depends on k, here, you actually have a different phase velocity and group velocity. And you guys have probably seen this before. If you just imagine you go out on the ocean and you look at, you see all the waves coming around, you spot out a peak, and you try to look at that peak for a little while, you'll notice that it disappears, and then you'll see another peak come up, and then it'll disappear, and another one will come up. And what's happening is every time you see a peak, it means there's a lot of different modes with different frequencies that happen to be in phase at a certain time. But because the phase velocity and group velocity are different, it then disperses, and then in another place they come into phase again. So that's the kind of wave I'm talking about here. Now the other limit is the shallow layer limit, and now the wavelength is much larger than the layer is thick. So the hyperbolic tangent becomes kh, and you get this important formula that we're going to see over and over again, which is omega squared is ghk squared. Okay, so remember that. So in this case, the phase velocity and the group velocity are the same. So this is actually the kind of limit you expect for tsunamis. You know, you have very large wavelengths. And you can really see the destructive power you have, because no matter what wavelength you have, they're all going to propagate at the same speed. And this is kind of the important one for us, because we want the large wavelengths. We're looking at these things from kiloparsecs away. We're not going to expect the little ripples on the surface to be giving us the least burst oscillations. Okay, so now that we kind of have an idea of what kind of modes we're looking at, let's look at what the surface of the neutron star is like. So to do that, we've constructed a simple cooling model of the surface layers of the star, and we kind of set the composition, what we expect for a helium-rich burst, from some more detailed numerical models. And then, so we take some initial profile, and basically, so this is going deeper into the star this way, and you, at some initial time, you have the burst go off, and everything up here burns very quickly. So the kind of profile you have is a high flux up here, like almost an Eddington flux, I think, and then not much of a flux down here, because this is all the ashes from previous bursts, nothing of this burned. So you start with this initial profile here, and this gives you a temperature profile like this. And then we just evolve this forward through time just using simple finite differencing techniques. So this is kind of how you'd expect the temperature profile to evolve over 10 seconds of time. It kind of just cools off, and you see a small thermal wave going in. So, but the picture is you're going to have this hot stuff up here, and then you have this cold stuff down here. And there's a large density difference between the two because of the difference in temperatures. And also because this is ashes, it has higher new ground numbers. Okay, so now just kind of looking at this picture as a cartoon, so you have the three different layers, you have these two different layers, the hot layer and the cooler ocean, and then below the ocean, at some point you have a crust where the material becomes crystalline. So the kind of the depths, I think about is this is about 1 meter in around here, this is about 2 meters in, and here's around 20 meters into the star. So these different interfaces between the layers are kind of natural places for the modes to live. So at each place, you have a buoyancy, and that's letting the modes are supported by that buoyancy. So for example, from right here, from going from hot to cold, you're going to have a shallow surface wave that can ride on this layer, and its frequency will be just like what we had before, ghk squared, where h is the height of this layer, but now modulated by how much buoyancy you have. So basically, the fractional change in density at this layer. Okay? And since I want these really long wavelength modes, I'm going to say that the wavelength kind of goes like the radius, modulo this factor of order unity that I'll discuss in more detail. Now, on the other hand, you can also have a mode that's kind of riding in the ocean on top of the crust. And just the same, there's a frequency GHK squared. But now it's modified by mu over p, which is where this is the shear modulus of the crust versus the pressure at that depth. And then notice that the scale head I'm using is the depth of the crust. So I'll discuss this dispersion relation in more detail and how we get this factor. So those are the two main modes to think about. So just to kind of get a better idea of what frequencies we expect, so for the shallow surface wave, we have the GHK squared times the fractional difference in density. So the scale height is just this guy here, as you expect. And then here's K squared, like I just told you before. And then the fractional change in density is just going to be 1 minus kind of our fractional change in temperature between the two layers. And then also the fractional change in mean molecular weight. Or not fractional change, but the ratio between the mean molecular weights. Okay, so I'm just assuming like an ideal gas for all this, which is good. Let's go back to this lambda factor. So if a neutron star is not rotating, then this is just kind of the wavelength you expect from spherical harmonics. So in that case, you just have this lambda that gives you L times L plus 1. But in the case we're interested in, we expect some of these stars to be spinning very rapidly. And because of that, this actually changes the lambda a lot from this typical value here. And the one we're going to be focusing on, and I'll explain in more detail why later, is lambda is about 1/9. So just take that as a given for now. And now we can plug in all these factors and see what kind of frequency we expect. And so we get something like 10 or 11 hertz for this mode. And the important scaling to notice is that you have this temperature factor, which is just from the scale height right here. And the scale height is changing as the layer cools. So the frequency should be changing, like the temperature in this bursting layer, to the 1/2 power. Okay. So that's the shallow surface wave. What about the crustal interface wave? Okay, so this wave actually was first noticed by McDermott and Van Horn and Hansen in some numerical models they did of the entire neutron star. And in those models, they said, okay, this is an interesting wave. They identified it and said, oh, it's a crustal interface wave. But they didn't really understand it very well because it was just one of the eigenvalue outputs of their the large simulation. So we've gone back recently in a paper that was just published about a month ago now, and actually looked at this mode analytically and actually kind of found a good explanation for how to understand the frequencies of this mode. So let's just imagine we have some wave, like a shallow surface wave, so you have this large kind of constant pressure perturbation moving across, and you're moving across a solid boundary. So this is like the neutron star crust. So in this case, this is just like the picture I drew before for these ocean waves. So this frequency would just be GHK squared. But what if the crust doesn't act like a solid? Okay, so what if as this pressure perturbation moves across, if it moves at the right frequency, the crust could actually almost like resonate with whatever frequency, if this moves with the right frequency. And in that case, the crust will kind of act like a flexible boundary. And so instead of having a solid, you'll have some displacement here. And what happens is that actually decreases your Mohs frequency. So instead of having GHK squared, like right here, it gets there's an extra factor, which is just the ratio of these two distances. Okay, and then from some simple analytic arguments of connecting the bottom boundary condition that the mode has to eventually die off up into the interface here between the crust and the ocean, you can show that this ratio is just given by the ratio of the shear modulus to the pressure. And what that does is now you have your shallow surface wave frequency, but it's going to be down by a factor of, once you take the square root, a factor of 10. Okay, so just plugging in some of the values, we get for this mode, of, instead of a frequency of like 40 hertz, like maybe we expect, only something around 4 hertz for this mode. Okay? And notice, since this scale height is at the crustal depth, it's going to depend on a temperature, but it's the temperature down by the crust. It doesn't know anything about the temperature up at the surface. So now we have some idea of these modes. We can go back and take these envelope models and actually do the full calculation of for these adiabatic modes, trying to find their eigenfunctions and eigenvalues. So here's the first three eigenfunctions that we find. So these are all using the same lambda of 1/9 or so. And in these pictures, I'm setting the mode energy to about 1/1000 of the energy from the burst. So you could kind of imagine there's enough energy budget to pull 1/1000 away and put it into some modes. So the first three modes we find is the surface wave. So you can see there's a frequency about what we expect, around 10 hertz. And for this mode, so this is the radial displacement, and here's the transverse displacement, and here's kind of the kinetic energy in the mode. And because I'm doing, I'm taking the log of the absolute value, whenever there's a node, it kind of looks like a cusp. So you can, if there wasn't this absolute value, the mode would be kind of going like this. Okay. So in this guy here, you can see there's this large displacement up at the surface right above my burning depth. So my burning is happening like right here. So this is really, it's really easy to identify this as the shallow surface wave. Now as I go down in frequency, I'm adding nodes. So this one has one node, this guy has two nodes, this guy has 1, 2, 3 nodes. So the next wave, like next eigenfunction I find is the crustal wave. And you can see it has a frequency just like I expect again from the analytics. And this guy, if you look at this kinetic energy, it's really concentrated down at the ocean, down right by where the crust is. So the crust is right here. And then if I keep on going, I start finding all the G modes now. So these ones each have more and more nodes, and then they have lower and lower frequencies as I keep on going up in a number of nodes. So now that I have these eigenfunctions, I can ask, once I perturb the star with these, how fast do I expect the mode to cool? So I can just estimate a radiative damping time, and so I've given them here. So basically, for the surface wave, I get something around 10, 20 seconds. For the crustal wave, I get something very long, which you could expect because all the energy is happening way down here. And to be able to propagate all that energy out, the thermal time is very long. So it would be hard to cool this mode once it was excited. And then finally, the G modes, they're kind of like the smallest amount of kinetic energy, so they actually cool very quickly in like less than a second. So given all this information, if I just had a star and I asked, out of these three modes, or even given even more G modes, which one do I expect to be excited or to persist on the star? This guy kind of has the best opportunity. And the reason why is because it has a long damping time scale that's at least longer than the time I'm looking at it, the time the cooling takes place. And then also it has a fairly large surface amplitude. So this is actually amplitude of order the radius of the star, for only having 1/1000th of the energy of the burst. Where, for example, the crustal wave, yeah, it has a long damping time, but you can see from the kinetic energy, there's not much energy going up to the surface. Okay, so I'm really going to want to focus on this mode throughout the rest of the talk.
Sorry, can you explain again why the G modes
are so fast? So one way to see it is G modes are characterized by having a constant energy density in a given region. So there's kind of like an interface here, and the G modes either have to be stuck above the interface or below. And in each region, they're going to have like a constant energy density. And and because of that, they're able to cool fairly. So if I want to compare that now with this mode, let's say, this guy actually, it's hard to tell because I'm showing this a large dynamic range. But there's actually like a factor of 10 difference and energy density from here. Okay, and that means it's going to take this. The energy is kind of like trapped below where all the cooling happens. The cooling, the rate of cooling happening at the surface. So this guy, the key is these are about constant, and you can see it even better if I, you know, if I had something with more radial nodes. But because of that, you're able, whatever is here is able to propagate from the surface very quickly, you know, very quickly. And actually, the difference in these damping times is about the same order as the difference in energies here. Okay, so now let's just look at the first two modes, the mode with a single node and the mode with two nodes, and look at their eigenfrequencies as a function of time, as this layer cools, the surface cools. So here's the eigenfunctions, eigenfrequencies I find. And the way to kind of think about this is it's almost like a quantum mechanics problem, like a perturbation theory problem. I have a changing potential, and I'm asking what's the energy of the eigenenergies of the system at different times. And so what's interesting is the frequency is actually decreasing of this wave right here, because it's like a surface wave, like I showed before. So it's actually decreasing like the t to the 1/2 power. Where the crustal wave won't change in frequency at all, because it doesn't know what's happening up at the surface. But if I keep following these, eventually they come comparable in frequency. And then right here, which I kind of highlighted in the inset plot, you actually have an avoided crossing between the two modes. Okay, so you have the same number of nodes on each continuous line, but the eigenfunctions qualitatively change a lot as I go from this side to this side. So here it's like a surface wave, but here you can see just from the frequency being really stable now, it kind of turns into a crustal wave. And I can see that even more if I look at the kinetic energy. So right here, okay, definitely a surface wave, it's all at the surface. Okay, now it's kind of in between, right? And I keep going down, and okay, now all the energy is concentrated down at the bottom of the ocean. Okay, so the mode actually really changes a lot going from here to here. But because of that the time scale this is changing is much larger than the mode frequency, just like, I guess it's almost like quantum mechanics where you have an adiabatic perturbation of your potential. And in that case, your mode or your eigenfunction will just march on and stay on the same parity. On the other hand, if you're changing potential really fast, what you would do if you were in your undergrad quantum mechanics class, right, is you'd have these two states here, and then you'd say, what's the probability of coming over here? And then you take, you know, your inner products and ask, you know, how much do these match up? And you'd have probabilities from going from here, then maybe switching over to here. But because this is happening so slow on the frequency time scale, you're just going to stay on that one parity. Okay, so that's kind of the story for the radial structure that we're going to be choosing. And now the question is, what's going to be the angular structure of the eigenfunction? So this has been identified already by Heil, but I'm kind of just I need to review it for you guys. So the first key is that the modes are highly sinusoidal, and the observations tell you that it's going to be like an m equals 1 or m equals minus 1 mode. Now the only difference between the two of these really, or the main difference between the two of these, is that one's moving retrograde on the star and the other is moving prograde with respect to the spin. Okay, so if you're an observer, you're going to see a frequency that's the difference between these two with the spin frequency times m. So let's just concentrate on m equals 1 or minus 1. If the mode is retrograde, which in the way I'm defining it here is m equals minus 1, then the observed frequency is just going to be the sum of the two. So then as this frequency decreases as the layer cools, an observer is just going to see a decreasing frequency, right? But if the mode is prograde, so this is m equals 1, an increasing frequency is observed. And you can see that because now this is decreasing, so you're subtracting off less and less from the spin frequency, so you're going to see overall an increasing frequency. So this tells you you need a prograde mode to give you the properties you see in the burst oscillations. So I kind of drew a picture of that here. Okay, but another key is because this frequency is actually so much larger than the mode frequency, you actually get changes to the latitudinal wavelengths also. So in the case of the spin frequency is really small, it doesn't really change it much, and you just kind of get a plus minus effect like this. But if it's spinning very rapidly, you can get changes of this lambda parameter away from the spherical harmonics values. So these are the rotational modifications. And since the layer is thin and the buoyancy is really dominating, you can versus the Coriolis forces, the radial structure is pretty much just determined by what I showed you guys before, because that's the buoyancy is determining all that. Now, but the Coriolis forces do come in, and what they do is they change the angular patterns on the surface. And there's a lot of different solutions to what different patterns you have, but they all correspond to different values of lambda for these modes. So I'm just going to give a flavor of some of the solutions, not all of them. And so I'm only concentrating actually all the positive M guys because I remember I want a retrograde mode. So for example, there's the inertial R modes. So this is a case when you're spinning fairly slowly. And what you notice is for the solution, in this case, the mode frequency ends up being actually about proportional to the spin frequency. So if you're one of these people that follow all the gravitational wave arm of those things, these are the kind of dispersion relations they like to use. But this is only applicable at small frequency, at small spin frequencies. So it's not in the limit that we're interested in here. Okay, so then we can ask, well, we want to spin this guy up more. And what kind of frequencies do we get now? And there's different kinds depending on the relationship between the L and the M values. So there's, now that you're spinning it up, they're called the buoyant R modes. And for right here is one where L is equal to M. And what you can see is now because you're spinning up faster, the Coriolis forces are really taking effect. And they're kind of squeezing everything down near the equator. And since now you can just see here, it's a smaller wavelength, right? So that corresponds to a much larger wave number, which is a much larger lambda value. So in these guys, you actually find a scaling that lambda kind of goes like the square of the spin frequency divided by the mode frequency. And for these systems, just given the size of the modes and the kind of spins around 300-600 hertz, these are going to be very big values of lambda. Now the problem is if I go back now and plug all these large values into lambda and look at what kind of frequency changes I'm getting from my modes for these shallow surface waves, I'm going to get these very large drifts. And it's not going to replicate what I see in the burst oscillation, so I want to throw them out for that reason. Another reason that's kind of easy to see here is all these guys actually have odd parity across the equator. So if I'm viewing it from here, let's say, these are going to subtract out. Okay, so I'm not going to get a very big perturbation.
Actually, on that problem, why is the mode manifesting itself as an asymmetry in the
x-ray velocity?
What is actually causing that?
So, I mean, so you have a temperature perturbation or pressure perturbations associated with these. And then as the, if you just ask what the flux coming through is, I mean, it's going to be modulated by those pressure differences. The easiest way to approximate is if you just take the rate of diffusion equation and just perturb it, you find that the fractional change in flux is going to be proportional to the fractional change in temperature modulo some factor that depends on your adiabatic exponents and stuff.
Okay.
So
I guess why I'm confused is because these are such a gravity waves, they're such an incompressible one. Why am I getting changes in temperature?
Yeah.
But I am getting changes.
Yes, you are. Yeah. So there's the canceling effect that makes this guy hard to see. And then the other thing is, this is all down near the equator. So depending on my viewing angle, or if there's still a disk there, it also will still it'll make it even harder to observe what's happening down where these moons are looking. So this is like Goldilocks, it's too cold, too hot, but then there's the just right one, right? So here's this case is where M is not equal to L. So this is L equals 2, M equals 1. It's a buoyant R mode because I'm still on this fast spin limit. But you can see now, for when these aren't equal to each other, you get these much wider eigenfunctions. And for this guy, it's actually even parity across here, so I don't have any of the canceling effects. So this is kind of the just right one, and this is the one. This has lambda equal to 1/9. Okay, so I can give more formulas and more detail of this if you guys are interested afterwards. Okay, so now I have all my components. I can put it together and try to look at what spin frequencies I get, or what burst oscillation frequencies I expect. So for here, I've plotted for a 400 Hertz neutron star spin, and I'm looking at what the observer would see. And this is for the same mode that I described on the previous slide. And so we've done three different models. And so the first one is just the model I actually showed the cooling for. And this is a helium burst composition, kind of everything you expect for these systems that are showing the burst oscillations. And you can see at first, there's like a 5 Hertz drift. And then eventually you switch into this crustal mode, and the frequency just stops evolving after that. So qualitatively, it really looks like the burst oscillations. So now we can ask, what if we start changing the model around a little bit? So for example, in this case, it's the same helium burst atmosphere, but now I have a hotter crust. There's more flux coming through the crust. And what that does is it now increases the frequency of the crustal mode so that this avoided crossing happens much sooner. And in this case, I only have a 3 Hertz drift. Okay? And then finally, for the third model, I've considered a hydrogen helium burst composition. And for this case, we actually never observed anything that should correspond to this. So it's an open question how relevant this is, but just for the sake of curiosity, we've run this model. And what's interesting in this case is because there's such a large density difference between this light stuff above and the stuff that's making up the ocean, you actually never see the switch. It happens way, at really late times. So, which is kind of strange, it doesn't give you the properties you observe, but on the other hand, it's not the kind of composition or the kind of atmosphere we expect to actually exist for these burst oscillations. But there's still an open question, why are we seeing these guys and not seeing a bunch of these guys? And one thing you observe if these guys existed is from burst to burst, you see a lot more variance in the asymptotic frequency, because it never turns into this crustal mode. So depending on how hot the burst was, how much material you burned, what the slightly different composition was each time, you'd actually see a lot more variance for these guys. So this all sounds nice. I've jumped through all these hoops just to be able to give you a picture that looked just like the burst oscillation. It's only one frequency, right? So it's kind of pathetic. But can we make any predictions about this? So that's always the real test, right?
What sets your final plateau on
the
why doesn't that change?
Okay, so the picture is there's the spin frequencies right here. Okay? And then it's this frequency right here. And then eventually the final frequency I'm asymptoting to is not the spin frequency, it's the crustal wave frequency. So this difference is about 4 Hertz, which is just the frequency between the crustal wave of the crustal wave. So this is determined by the physics of the neutron star crust.
And that's more.
And that's at such deep levels that it's not going to change.
Radius of the whole star.
No. This is at about 20 meters or so.
No, but I mean, yeah. Okay. The point is, that it's not going to be changing from burst to burst because it's okay.
Yes.
Sorry, and so the implication of the oscillations that you see in the rise of the burst have nothing to do with a spreading burning front on the star.
No. So the this is at like the burst peak going on. So the stuff in the very very rise.
Yeah.
It's still the spreading of the burning material.
And the spin frequency is not low, it's high, right? Yeah.
Oh, so the one I showed is just one example. There's some where it shoots up, it does all sorts of wild stuff at the beginning, but it ends up in the same ballpark. But you can't really trust the asymptotic frequency in that case because the layers could be hydrostatically expanding and compressing and stuff, and that would be changing the spin frequency. So the first comparison we thought of doing is comparing with the actual drifts that are seen. So just to remind you, here's the analytic expressions that I gave before for the surface wave and the crustal wave. And what we're going to say is, well, from burst to burst, the temperature that you get to is about the same at the peak. So let's just leave that for now. But there's more uncertainty in what this crust is actually doing, what its properties. So the crustal wave frequency basically depends on two factors. the temperature of the crust, and the composition of the crust. Okay, and the thing to remember is that if the crust is hot, then the crustal wave frequency is higher, and so you're going to get smaller shifts. So we expect the neutron stars that are accreting at higher rates to actually show smaller shifts. And so what we've done is gotten more detailed crustal models from Ed Brown of Michigan State, and then we've compared these with the observed drifts and persistent luminosities of these systems. So this is actually just using this analytic formula here. And so here's all the systems sitting here. And then the symbols just mean either you have a radius expansion burst or no radius expansion. And the horizontal bars are actually the range of luminosities that have been seen from these systems. So to pick out an average, we just kind of put a point at the average spot. But the thing is, just so there's a correlation here, which actually has never been pointed out before, and that is the guys with the larger shifts tend to be at lower persistent luminosities, and vice versa. And then we've plotted from these analytical formulas what phase shift, what frequency shifts we expect for an iron atmosphere, and then I think it's like palladium. So this is kind of what you expect in the helium burst, some sort of alpha elements coming out of it, and this is something you expect when you have all these proton captures happening in one of these hydrogen helium bursts. And you can see, well, for one thing, the correlation, the kind of the overall picture matches what we expect for how we expect the frequency shift to change with the luminosity. The other thing that's really interesting is it actually, these systems correlate better with the iron-like atmosphere, I mean the iron-like crustal composition, which is exactly what we expect for these systems based on what kind of bursting properties they have. So this is a really exciting check because, I mean, it almost felt contrived going through all these hoops to try to get the frequency shifts to fit and so forth. And so, but when we plotted this up, we had no idea what we were going to get. So when they correlated, we were very happy. Okay, so the other comparison you can do is we've thrown out all these other angular eigenfunctions. So we've only kept this one that matches the actual observations, but there's all these other ones that are sitting there. And we have no reason why we see one and not the other ones, except for these observational factors that we discussed. But so what we apply here is, versus time, all the other frequencies we expect. And so there's, of course, an infinite number, but these are some of the low-order angular order ones. And so here's the spin frequency. This is a 600 Hertz spinning neutron star. And here's what the mode we call the burst oscillation from the previous discussion. So then you see there's all these other modes here. And the thing to take away is because lambda is typically much larger for these values, for these modes than this one R mode that we've been picking out, the frequency shifts you get are much larger. So if you actually were an observer taking your light curve and doing a Fourier transform of the light curve, it might all get smeared out because, for example, this has like a 100 Hertz frequency shift. So what's interesting is maybe all these frequencies are there, but they're all hidden in the light curves. And it just takes a creative observer to go and find them. So actually, I think Deepto Chakrabarty and a student at MIT are now going through, there's a huge database of these things, and looking at frequency shifts that are changing by a lot more. So you actually accelerate your light curve and then do a Fourier transform to see if any of these guys are actually hiding. But none of this has been confirmed yet.
Sorry, so where's the L equals 2, N equals minus 1 R mode?
So, what did you want?
The one that's...
So R modes are also, R modes are only retrograde.
So that's the Kelvin mode, is it?
So yeah, so what you so if this is an L equals 1, M equals minus 1 mode, and so this is a prograde, kind of the prograde analog of an R mode.
Where's the L equals 2,
M
equals minus 1?
I don't have it here, but the M, the L equals 2.
I mean, I'm just going to ask you why you prefer actually exciting the prograde versus the retrograde or vice versa.
Well, I'm not sure.
So, but is the other version of that mode on this graph? Does it also have a high frequency drift?
So L equals, I'll come back to that. But yes, it would have a frequency drift that would be very large also. also,
okay.
So the thing to take away is when you have these Coriolis effects, they're not symmetrical between prograde and retrograde modes.
I see, right, of course. I see. Okay.
So they right. actually, the prograde ones
right.
show a lot larger frequency shifts.
I see.
Okay. Okay, so just to conclude, so we've proposed a new explanation for the burst oscillations, and it's really actually the first explanation that fits the frequencies and the shifts that are observed, which is pretty amazing, right? Because it's only one frequency, but that's how it goes. So we proposed that what's happening is you have a surface wave up in this bursting layer, and it's decreasing in frequency as the layer cools, and then you have this transition into a crustal wave. And this is pretty exciting because now it actually gives some testable predictions. So we can either use it to try to learn, you know, correlate it with the accretion properties of the neutron stars and either test this, this hypothesis or actually try to learn something about the burning processes and the accretion processes of the neutron stars. But there's still a lot of open questions, what's going on. So, for example, a big outstanding one is why is it just a short burst only? Is it something to do with the composition? Is it, for example, something to do with the excitation mechanism of the modes? Okay, so, and the same thing, why is it just this one mode out of all these different angular eigenfunctions that we have? But we're optimistic now that we can actually try to learn something more about these neutron stars using this picture. So, I'll end there.
Only expect this,
right?
How much can you allow yourself to excite other than you're hiding them all, like, for different reasons?
So, I mean... So, you can ask, okay, what's the easiest one to observe? And not worry about these excitation mechanisms. So that was something that Heil actually did. But some places around how he compared the modes maybe weren't fair. But he did find that by far this mode was the one that would give the largest amplitude. Just because of basically because of these qualitative arguments, that it's symmetric or symmetric around the equator, it's covering a large latitudinal extent, and that kind of thing. Other people are working on all different kinds of not that many people, but there's other people working on different excitation mechanisms, and they do look promising that this mode would be. The one excited, but.
We need it that you're dumping large fractions of that mode to avoid dumping somewhere else where you would see it maybe not as easily, but enough so that.
That's not well explained at this point. Why that mode is. Why that mode's only being excited. Or that's the one mode we've seen. I mean, I haven't really addressed that issue.
If this mode identification is correct and you make a very possible case that it is, how much should the burst energy be in this mode?
Well, it depends on what you believe for the... So I've done some simple estimates of the amplitude you expect. So here's just kind of the surface pressure perturbation in a fractional, which the flux perturbation is kind of proportional to this. And so in these cases, I'm taking something of order 10 to the minus 3 of the energy of the burst. And you can see I'm getting perturbations of order unity. And so these are for my three different models. So it doesn't really take that much energy.
Measurement of the actual flux variations that you see and translate that into
So I haven't done that yet. So that's an interesting question. So you kind of expect, just from simple arguments, that the flux perturbation would be maybe a fifth of this or so. Two-fifths of this, I think, is the number. So the actual observations, so you can see how the actual observations, so these are different burst oscillations, and the bottom plot are the RMS amplitudes. And so these are, you think, actual flux. So, it's of order exactly what I just said. It's about order 1 minus, divided by about 5 or something. So qualitatively, these are kind of, what I was finding, but I haven't done much more work on that yet.
Okay, but 1,000 then is about the right number.
Yeah, that's not. So, I mean, it's not crazy. At least it's not more than.
Yeah. Sure.
You have it there. I don't know.